Ibrahim, you've just written a book, and it's called Green Dean, What Islam Teaches About Protecting the Environment. How did you come to write it?
Well, let's see. So I come from the youth activism world, and in 2002, a small group of us created a database of youth organizations called the Future 500, which is youth organizing and activism in the United States. So we mapped the youth left. We nurtured it. We helped it grow. We helped it grow into the all-out movement that helped elect President Obama in 2008. Back then, we were just voices crying out in the wilderness, but over time, we grew into a formidable movement. And in 2004, with momentum building, I left my job then as the director of youth programs at Brooklyn's Prospect Park, and then I helped establish the Brooklyn Academy for Science and the Environment, and then I went west to work with the Movement Strategy Center, which is a progressive think tank in Oakland, California. And it became clear to me that young people like myself, who were maturing from youth activists, would suddenly be called to serve at a much greater level, and we would be needed to lead and to govern. And this was pre-Obama, and I remember asking myself, if one of our progressive leaders today were to take power, would we be prepared? So all of us activists running around the streets, doing protests, working with young people, would we be prepared to govern? Fundamentally, I was interested in whether we would be able to manage basic systems that we take for granted. Would we even know how to manage agencies that we had no institutional memory of? So in an attempt to be prepared to lead and to govern, I decided to go to graduate school for public administration. And while at school, I became attracted to the work that was happening at Green for All. In California, previously, I had been in contact with Van Jones and a number of folks that were connected to the Green Jobs Movement. So while I was in grad school, I attended a retreat at Garrison with some of the leaders of the environmental movement and became convinced that the environmental path was something that I had been following all along, but kind of didn't know it. It was something that had just been there that I was connected to, but I sort of took my connection to the environment for granted. The Green Jobs Movement seemed to make a lot of sense to me. And then as I started to involve myself in my studies, I became convinced that the left was right about a lot of things. And since we had data and facts and figures to back us up, the reality about the need to respond fully to the threats of our ecological crisis was very clear to me. Then in grad school, I began studying libertarian ideas and thoughts. I never fully embraced those ideas, but I came to respect them and got a better understanding in that process of what a great many Americans hold dear. And soon, in this process, I became hungry for other perspectives that were not typically my own. And coming from a guy like myself, I went to college in Rhode Island. I grew up in Brooklyn. I lived upstate New York. I lived in Boston. I lived in Oakland. Pretty liberal enclaves. So a key moment in the development of Green Dean came when I was at the Green for All Summit in Memphis, Tennessee, which coincided with two things: marking the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and oddly enough, the NCAA's Final Four in men's basketball, which included the Memphis team's basketball team. So we're in Memphis, and Memphis is playing. So feeling like I was preaching to the choir and needed to get a fresh perspective, I was also feeling like the conversations were hyper secular. So I was inspired by the movement, inspired by the gathering, but I wanted a fresh perspective and left the conference and walked through the streets, and they were filled with revelers from the NCAA win that Memphis had just had. And then I came upon a restaurant with some local folks, a bunch of Christians. There was nothing I could eat there because it was mostly pork stuff. Mm-hmm. But after telling them that I was from New York City and making it clear that I was not from the South, I asked them what they thought about climate change. And they told me that it climate change was like Democrats trying to get them to be afraid of something, just like terrorists trying to get them to be afraid of Republicans trying to get them to be afraid of terrorism. So I knew right then and there that we wanted to really transform our pollution-based economy, we needed to make sure that we connected with all people. And some people are motivated primarily by their faith. It would take a couple of years for me to get to the right situation, the right opportunity. But there was some prodding from people like Bracken Hendricks, by Adolfo Wilson in Newark, Ring Kusen of the Applied Research Center, Rami Nashasibi of the Inner City Muslim Action Network. And I did research with all of them, and it helped me understand the Muslim community to a greater extent. My evolution into writing this book was identifying that there was not a plain language, accessible, popular-focused book about Islam and the environment out there. So I wanted to fill that niche.
Can you, the name of the book is Green Dean, and Dean is D-E-E-N, and that's a word that might be unfamiliar to a lot of people. Can you tell us what it means and why you put it in the title?
Certainly. So a dean is a path, it's a religion, or it's a way. So all religions are deans. So in the Quran, it says, Lakum deen waliya deen, which means to you your way and to me mine. So just by background, I'm a descendant of enslaved Africans. My parents are, but I'm mixed with Native American, descendants of slaves, and also Irish, which is the composition of many African Americans. My mother and my father joined the Nation of Islam, which was essentially a community empowerment organization which attracted a great many followers. Those of whom were looking for something deeper and more spiritually oriented transitioned to becoming Orthodox Muslims, Sunni or Shia. So I'm of the generation that were the children of those converts. Mm-hmm. And similarly, at the same time, an influx of immigrants in the past 40 years brought a great many Muslims from all over the globe, and they too had many children. So one thing that connects both the converts and the immigrants is that they had a great deal of courage. Courage to move to another country, courage to raise your children in another culture, courage to change your religion, which is crazy, and courage to create a culture within a culture. So we are the children are very much experiments, and part of that experiment was in creating language that made sense to us. So the word deen is an Arabic word, but it has become part of the American Muslim slang in a sense. So people would say, are you on your deen, or how's your deen? And that becomes part of the way we talk to each other.
Great, thanks. I want to go back to that conversation you had with the Christians in the restaurant in Memphis, Tennessee. People feeling like the Democrats are just trying to scare them and that global warming is just a hoax. It's made up. And since the midterm elections, we've been hearing sort of a reprise of that by a lot of conservatives saying the same thing, challenging the notion of global warming and saying it's just a lot of hokum. And in fact, I read this morning a conservative representative who I think is going to have, a Republican, I think is going to have a reasonably responsible position in the new Congress, saying that we don't have to worry about climate change or global warming because he's a Christian and God told Noah that there would only be one flood on this earth. And so, you know, Bangladesh and all those countries don't have to worry about being inundated because God won't let it happen because that's what the Bible says. So how do you read, you know, going forward, what we do about this real change, and then people whose religion, in fact, does inform their views on global warming, but in a really different way, and it kind of overrides policy and science even.
You know, I think one thing communities of faith have a hard time doing is admitting that they're wrong. And you know, we have this moral authority, and that's how it exists. You know, for eons, essentially, it feels as though we are right. We are the we have that moral sense of superiority, and that's one of the first things that needs to happen. Because the real truth is that regardless of whether some scientific data is real or not, is absolutely not the point. You can argue about scientific data forever, but people have to admit that we can do things better. So I like to talk about, how can we just do things fundamentally better? It's about meaning that we've done a lot with pollution-based resources. We've made a lot of great strides using extractive practices. Now we need to create new systems that are just plain better for people's health and for the planet. And I think part of this rejection of global warming is a form of being afraid of change and afraid of the future and afraid of your own self and afraid of the power of the human imagination to recreate and to refashion the best of what we have. As a Muslim, we're blessed to have it very clearly stated in the Quran that there are things that human beings can do to negatively affect the planet that does not come from God. You know, we all make choices. So I think part of what we do, I think, in response on a political level is sort of really focusing on the quality of life pieces. So I think we've spent a lot of time focusing on facts and figures and proving people right instead of saying, well, let's talk about your life. Let's talk about where this connects for you. Let's talk about the water that you actually drink. Let's talk about the air that you actually breathe. And let's talk about your health. Let's talk about your mother and your grandmother and your father and your grandfather. And how are they? And really honing in on the human impacts of all of the effects and the consequences of climate change, and not even talk about climate change in that same language, but really make it a personal issue.
And then what do you hope to see happen after that, if people do make connections and they say, oh yeah, myself, my water, my air, my grandmother, illnesses in the family, asthma, whatever it might be, then what's the next step after that?
So I think that communities of faith really need to band together and become much more of a source of strength for the environmental movement. The environmental justice movement began with the United Church of Christ in North Carolina, leading the way, researching environmental racism, finding empirical evidence, and using that to help inform the movement's development. So that was putting people ahead of just these blobs of empty space. And I think that that was the template in the past for communities of faith to really lead. And the way that we can do that now is by becoming a block, the way that the labor industry has traditionally been a block for Democrats, or the way that other industries are, oil and coal and gas are blocks of voters for, traditionally Republicans and other big business interests. I think that communities of faith that are really concerned about poverty, that are really concerned about the quality of people's lives, can form a really effective voting block to really support and help the environmental movement.
Can you talk about some interfaith efforts that are going on that Muslim Americans are participating in? And also, can you talk about any growing awareness of environmental issues, environmental justice, caring for creation in the Muslim American community, which is being battered in so many ways by so many things? That does this feel like one more issue, or does this feel very important?
You know, I will say that Muslims have a tendency to feel as though everyone's attacking them, and at this moment we are the punching bag. But we're also hypersensitive. So I think sometimes we are unable to actually give energy to other struggles and other issues and other concerns. So part of the reason why I wrote this book was identifying that there are some areas of growth for the Muslim American community to really look at other struggles and other issues and jump on board with them. So the environmentalism that's happened within the Muslim community and the interfaith collaboration, so those are two different things. The interfaith collaboration has been primarily around civil rights issues and around how are we going to support each other to be able to have the right to worship. It has not evolved or matured into other spaces. I was recently at the Festival of Faith in Louisville, Kentucky, and that's where you start to see the whole conversation was about what is our responsibility to the soil, the sacred soil, and you start to see different communities of faith telling their stories. The year before it was about water. Next year it'll be about air. So I think what really needs to happen, and what has been happening in some cases, is that some communities are starting to have conversations. And it's different than dialogue, where dialogue was more about, let's understand where we're different. I think that these conversations are starting to say, okay, we all have this principle of being the steward. We all have this principle and this idea of being the representatives of God on earth. And what does that mean for Christians? What does that mean for Jews? What does that mean for Muslims? And we're finding that most people have a lot in common. Now, the hard work, where the hands are getting in the soil, that is a little bit further off, I think, in terms of actual physical projects being done. The D.C. Green Muslims is a group that's been doing some work in the D.C. area. There's a lot of work around food within the Muslim community related to halal, organic, free-range food that, for Muslims and for others. And that's like Yasser Saeed of greensabiha.com, this brother Qaed Hassan in the Chicago area, where he's been helping food farmers markets, and he's been working with local Christian farmers to get the produce into the inner city in Chicago. Yasser Saeed, who does Green to Beha, he goes out and he slaughters his animals on Amish land. So they've been working in partnership to, these free-range animals on Amish land, and it's a deep partnership between a Muslim and a Christian. The Inner City Muslim Action Network in Chicago, they've been doing bringing young men out of prison and getting them involved in reentry work. I mean, work on energy efficiency, work on homes, and then they can live in the homes. And so they've been walking around and connecting with folks in the community through that way. So there's a lot of points where it's happening, but now that work needs to be elevated. And I think that as we move from a place of sort of insular dialogue and into a larger conversation, I think the Muslim community is going to really lead, hopefully, in this regard.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you say in your book is that the whole earth is a mosque. And I guess what you've just been saying reflects that view. Is that right?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, that phrase comes directly from the hadith, which is one of the sayings of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. He was responding to a questioner, one of the companions, who inquired about the first mosque ever being built. And the Prophet responded and elaborated by saying that the earth is a mosque for you, so wherever you are at the time of pray, pray there. Emphasizing two things. One is that, yes, prayer is important, and that's, you know, critical. And part of the beauty of being Muslim and the beauty of our prayer five times a day is that it's aligned with the motion of the earth. So as a Muslim and as you exercise your deen, getting into that rhythm of the day, it's almost as if Allah is saying, get into this rhythm. Get into understanding the way you relate to the planet at different times of the day. And this, for me, this speaks to the sacredness of everything. It reminds us of our connection to the planet, that it must be kept clean, kept sacred. And I've been riding my bike over the Manhattan Bridge, and every time I get to the very end, I see a man who's meditating. He's some sort of monk, and he's meditating there, and amidst Chinatown, the smells, the cars, the trains, and that's what the Earth is a Mosque is about. He's surrounded by this mess, but he's reclaimed that space, and he's made it sacred. So emphasizing that the Earth is a Mosque is similar, that we have to remember that everything is sacred, and we have to reclaim that idea.
Is he sitting on the ground, right on the sidewalk?
He is sitting. He's not on the sidewalk. He's like, there's like a small area that it's strange how it's connected, but it's right before you get to the sidewalk. It's
okay.
Right when you get off the bridge, right at the approach, and he's in the midst of all this hecticness.
Wow, traffic and everything.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Mm. Wow. I want to go back to your book for a second. And you've organized, and you talk about speaking in very plain English and to folks and, you know, getting rid of the science and the charts and the really complicated, confusing things to really touch people's lives. And so you've organized your book into four parts, and it's called Waste, Watts, like electrical watts, Water, and Food. Why did you pick those four things as an organizational structure?
So the framework came from a talk that I was asked to give in 2003 at the behest of the late Councilman James E. Davis. He was gunned down at City Hall in 2003. And he and I were acquainted when I was at Prospect Park. And one day he and his staff and I were talking about the future and what communities of color had to do to be aware of. And I was just getting interested in the most, I'll be honest, I was really interested in composting toilets for some odd reason. And
yep.
I was like, wow, we all need to have composting toilets. And I really got inspired by distributed energy generation. And so I had an inkling that it would be something, the future would be something related to that. And so I was trying to convince James, and he's like, this doesn't make sense to me, but if you can explain it to these guys that I know, then maybe we can do something with it. And these guys that he knew were basically a bunch of like rough and tumble construction worker black men from the projects that were just like his sounding board. And so he had me meet him at a school after work. So all these rough guys came in, and they were like just working men, family men, and he was like, all right, explain it to these guys. And I was like, I had no idea how to explain it. And so I was like, all right, so water, waste, and watts. So I was like, the three W's. And then I just was like, broke it down through that. And I said, this is how we organize systems. And you know, these are main systems that we organize our life around. And you can determine our priorities based on how we manage these systems. So for the book, I just expanded that framework and then added in food because I thought it was a really clear way to see how we manage those systems and how different civilizations throughout history, you know, you can determine their priorities by how those systems were managed. And it's an interesting way to look at history if you look through that lens.
Let's talk about the future. So we've had the midterms. Faith communities are doing their work. Muslim American communities are active in their own way. You're doing your work. Your great book has just come out. What do you think needs to happen in the next days, weeks, months, years regarding environmental protection, both individual work and policy work. And can you connect the dots to help us get there?
I hope I can.
It's really easy, right?
Solve the problem.
Solve the problem, right.
So two myths I think that need to be debunked. One is that industry is afraid of further regulation. So this coming from the place where climate change and climate disruption, environmental policy regulation is going to really significantly hinder innovation, I think is a false premise. And I think we need to figure out the right way to debunk that. Part of the problem is that industry needs certainty to operate and needs things to be clear. So we need to be very clear that these policies are going to go forward. And the only way that it's very clear is if the people who actually support them and the elected officials who actually support them really are able to voice their opinions and voice what they think. And that will rest on, similarly like we just saw with these midterm elections, we had people sweep in that said, this is our agenda. The folks that are that really are behind these issues need to really start to force the hand and say, listen, this is our agenda. And the way that we do that, I think, is not by always focusing on specific heads of organizations. Like, for example, you don't always have to focus on the president or the mayor in any context. I think that people of faith and people that are interested in this area need to start to identify it, the leaders of agencies, the leaders of different entities, and really focus and target their support or their criticism or their specific policy concerns to that level. So to be a little bit more strategic and to learn how to play an inside-outside game. That means sometimes conceding on some areas and compromising on others, but really getting a sense of a base of trust up with different organizations that make these decisions. The other thing I think, and related back to that point about industry, is that it is in the best interest if we can clean up the planet, because then we'll possibly open up new markets or we'll improve markets that already exist. So I think that story has to be told, that there's actually economic gain and prosperity to be found in transforming our relationship with the planet. And we can lead again. And I think that a lot of people have been making this point. And I think part of it is not just beating people over the head or saying it like, duh, you don't get this. We have to be very humble about this. And this is the place that we have a lot of challenge. Humility is not the best suit for those of us that have been talking about these issues for a long time. And so we need to get a little bit of a dose of humility just to do it in the right way, to hit people where they're really passionate about. And then finally, I think on a practical level, I think people need to just say, okay, fine, this is fine. People that are in power may not do what we want them to do, and that's okay, right? And this is where that old-fashioned American libertarian strain comes up in me, and it's like, it's fine if the government's not going to do something. We have to demonstrate, just like, for example, if there's a market for a good, the people determine what companies make or what companies don't make, because they will buy or not buy something. Well, citizens can determine what policies should and should not be and what things should not be standard practice by actually demonstrating the value of those things. So we should figure out ways to not wait, right? So if you know that you need to that a fuel oil is dirty and it's polluting the air, don't wait for government regulation. Go and change your boiler. Simple as that. Organize other communities to do the same thing. If you know that there's other examples of things that small things that communities can do, creating play streets in certain areas, transforming the way that you manage your garbage at the church level, at the mosque level. Do those things and demonstrate the savings, demonstrate the community involvement, demonstrate any other sort of indicator that shows that people are getting engaged, people are becoming a part of it, and people are changing the way they think about their relationship to the planet in the process. The more that we can demonstrate those things, the more policies will follow us.
Do you think that's happening?
I do actually think it's happening. And the reason why I say that is because I went, and I think it's actually happening on college campuses in some ways, where, where you have three garbage bags or three garbage receptacles in certain places where you have the recycle, the landfill, and the composting. Just that physical act is very, very, very interesting and a very amazing social experiment to see how people get used to a certain process. If that was something that children are accustomed to, that won't be something that's odd or weird or strange or any extra effort. So, but on college campuses, that's like becoming the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if I'm in like a municipal building or some, you know, it's different. It may not, you know, folks that are older, we're a little curmudgeonly, and it's out of our normal operating procedure. But I think it's actually happening, and it's actually happening without us really realizing it.
Well, that sounds great. Well, Ibrahim, thank you so, so much for talking with us. Is there anything I haven't asked you that feels important that you would like to say?
That's a great question. I just want to reemphasize that, you know, communities of faith, I think one of our challenges is that we don't admit when we're wrong. And it's in a sense that communities of faith have been uniquely complicit in the pollution based economy, and part of that is, for example, in the Muslim world, where Muslim countries, you know, are produce most of the oil that we use in the world. And my argument to folks that are in the developing world or places where they're like, well, the West has done it, and why can't we catch up?
Mm-hmm.
My argument is that we can do better than that. People around the globe that are in developing nations, that are developing their economies, and people in the United States that are in these small, you know, old mill towns that are decrepit and that are broken down, like the city I went to high school in, Troy, New York, that are just, you know, beat up places. Those places can lead if they are committed to innovation. They can lead if they're committed to finding a new way to do things. And at any moment in American history, you've had two things for economic growth. You've had increased efficiency, and you've had manufacturing, you know, building up manufacturing. And so I think that those are the two things that we need to focus on as a people. And being a Muslim, this is really, it resonates for me that communities of faith really have to come together. Like, we don't have to talk about what we think about God. We don't have to talk about what our creed is. We don't have to have that conversation at all. In fact, I don't want to have that conversation. Really, all I want to do is figure out what are the products that we need to create? What are the processes that we need to transform? And what are the ways that we can fundamentally alter the way we actually operate on a daily basis so that we can all benefit from making the planet better? Those are the main things that I'm focused on. It's less about the ideas and more about the work. And, you know, people have a lot of ideological differences, but who is truly about making people's lives better? Who's about doing the work? And that's what I'm interested in.
Well, again, thank you very, very much for talking with us. Thanks for writing your book, Green Dean, What Islam Teaches About Protecting the Environment, and good luck with the good work you do, and thanks for doing it.
The only thing I'll say is it's what Islam teaches about protecting the planet. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, the planet. Forgot it. Sorry. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
But thank you very much.
Thanks.